have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here, another episode of the Business Broker Growth Show. Today I have my friend Shane Owen. Oh my God, why did Shane come from? Oh, your middle name. That's a All right. Let's do this again. All right. 3, 2, 1. Hey everybody, Jason here, another episode of the Business Broker Growth Show. Today I have with me my friend Brandon Owens. He is a business broker, First Choice Business Brokers of Cincinnati. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm excited. It's fun because I think of these conversations and I think of what's led to them and the conversations we have offline and kind of prep for this. And each one is so fun because everybody's got a different path. Everyone's got a different kind of experience leading up to being a business broker while being a business broker and all of those. And I think what's fun about yours is a little bit different. I know that your origin was first trying to buy a business, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I was in manufacturing for a long time, and then I got tired of living out of a suitcase. And you know, I mean, you know, there's corporate America will suck the living life out of just about anybody, and I was no exception. But I was going to buy a business, and I thought, you know, I'm going to be the, you know, captain of my own destiny and buy a business. And that process was frustrating to me. One, because there's so few business brokers out there. And two, they are so swamped with buyers that you're in a pool of thousands of other people searching for these limited number of listings, some of which are worth buying, and couldn't get an audience with this business broker. And I just remember thinking back then, good Lord, this is not a very populated business brokerage, that is. And there are so many of the then business brokers that were in their elder years going to retire themselves. And then you couple that with the silver tsunami that's coming up, and it was a good time to jump in. It was a scary jump, but it was a good time to jump in.
How long ago was that when you were trying to buy it? It was frustrating. And then you're just like, wait a second,
over 7 years ago. And I've been a business broker for 6 years. So you can do the math and you can see that I didn't jump in right away. It took me a little while to cut the umbilical cord between a regular salary paycheck and this business, which is a little scary from one quarter to the next sometimes. So, yeah.
About some of the stuff that you said, because it's fascinating to think that there's not enough business brokers out there, because at some points it feels like there's too many business brokers out there, but you know, it's still fundamentally, it's just not. Like, I know I had Andy Cagnetta on the show early in the podcast, and he was like, if everyone actually decided to sell their business, like this silver tsunami wave, like there's too much supply and not enough like brokers out there. How do you feel it is now, like 6 years, 7 years later, as far as the balance between the business brokers that are available and what's out there for sale?
Well, I think technology has certainly changed part of this landscape because it's so much easier for outreach. I run into business owners all the time, and they're almost getting sick of being approached by business brokers because a lot of the outreach is through, you know, email campaigns, LinkedIn outreach, Facebook outreach, you name it. So that has changed even during the 6 years that I've been a business broker. But what hasn't changed in this industry and what is getting kind of lost is just direct outreach. You know, I mean, learning the local community that you're in and rubbing elbows with business owners and letting people know who you are and that you're a resource. Because, you know, if you're selling a business in Ohio, most business owners don't want to list a business with somebody in California. No offense to anyone in California, but you know, being local helps. So there's still that human aspect to this business, without a doubt. But that has started to change in the last 6 years that I've been in this business.
And changed what? Because of technology and because of COVID and those.
Yeah,
kind of
you know, I don't think COVID has as much to do with it as it's just technology itself. I mean, through social media And, you know, even older guys like myself are learning that we have to use, you know, digital outreach mechanisms of some sort, Facebook, Google, you name it. And that has kind of expanded the what we can capture in a net. And I mean, you can take an email campaign and you could hit thousands of businesses every month. And, you know, with a flyer or some sort of pitch that says, you know, hey, well, you know, are you ready to retire? Let us sell your business. But it doesn't mean that that broker is actually going to show up at your closing. And it doesn't mean that when you show your business for the first time and need your handheld, that they're actually going to fly to your location to do that. Mm-hmm. So kind of been a diluting of that personal touch in this industry through that use of social media. But as far as the original question, you'll have to remind me how we even started down this road on this particular question, but I'm hoping I answered the question.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's interesting because of the you know, looking at, you know, where there might be more business brokers now versus 7 years ago, or is it just newer business brokers versus the old guard leaving and the people retiring and leaving the industry?
Well, even within our own family of first choice offices, which have doubled since I started, there are many more younger faces joining the crowd. And what they're bringing to the business is actually some of that digitization, some of that social media outreach, and they're working smarter and not harder. Whereas, you know, the original business broker method was mailers, right? You know, snail mail and actual physical outreach, you know, calling somebody on the phone. And those tools still apply even to this day, because you got to keep in mind your demographic when you're reaching out to these silver tsunami business owners. They're not on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as much as, say, younger folks are.
Yeah.
And they do open their mail and they do answer their phone, and a lot of them are chatty. They don't mind talking about their business. So, you know, those original tools actually still work, and they work quite well. If you couple that though with digital outreach, then of course you're going to improve your results without a doubt. So we're seeing even in our own offices, some very successful young folks getting into this business that are doing a marvelous job. They're running circles around, you know, brokers like me, and it's impressive. And I applaud them for it, you know. But the business itself is still relatively unchanged. You know, I mean, to say that there's only 4,000 business brokers out there, and I'm not even sure where that data comes from. I've just heard that data set several times over.
Yeah.
Within the business brokerage industry, you still have tiers of different business brokers. There are some people that are commercial realtors that occasionally sell a business and consider themselves a business broker, but maybe they're not an expert at doing valuations like a really well-trained business broker is, or maybe they don't have their CBI designation, which means you've had the discipline to take several classes through IBBA and get your certified business intermediary designation. So there's not all of them are created equally. And I've even seen residential realtors try to sell businesses for business owners. And ethically and professionally, they have no business doing it whatsoever. I've literally taken listings from existing business owners who listed their business initially with a residential realtor, not saying that they weren't capable, but there was no valuation of the business done. You know, they just went with what price the owner wanted and they failed. And there was no mystery as to why they failed, and the outreach wasn't there. You know, the method of just throwing something out there on a website and standing there with a catcher's mitt and hoping someone's going to call, that just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. And there's a lot that goes into it. I know for you, one of the things that we talked about was your entry into this and how the first year went, which is probably similar to a lot of people's first years, unless they have a really big network or they're part of a group that has some marketing feeding them, right? Well, how was it for you in the beginning?
Well, you know, our business model was, you know, you join a group and you initially get, you know, several leads that are provided by whichever franchise you join. I don't care who it is. But in this business, as in any business where, you know, you are the income, it's up to you. I mean, you have to do that outreach. You have to get on the phone and call business owners that meet the profile or the type of business that you're looking to engage. And my first year was no exception. You know, most people that I talk to that are thinking about getting into this industry, either as a broker or just an agent, I tell them, you know, the first year you're going to be eating ramen noodles and baked beans. And then once you get to that ninth to 12th month, you can start surfing turf again, because it takes a while to get a pipeline of listings under your belt.
Yeah.
And two or three listings is not going to make your day. It takes a dozen or more decent listings in order to, you know, to make a decent living at it. Is it impossible to do that? No, I did that my first year, but the payday didn't come until right at the end of that year. And I think three businesses sold in 1 week, you know, and right about the same time, I think I was ready to pull chalks and leave and say, okay, I'm going back to manufacturing. This is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I had some renewed faith in this industry, because you close three businesses in 1 week and you take that many checks to the bank, it's a good feeling, but it's work and it's patience, and it takes tenacity that a lot of people don't have when they're watching some of their savings go out the door, because you're still having to pay for marketing. You still got to pay for, you know, a seat on Biz Buy Sell. You definitely want that presence, you know. So money's going out the door for the first 6 to 12 months, and then it starts coming back in. When it starts coming back in, if you're doing the things you should be doing, it's coming in droves.
So it's interesting, because once you get past that first, you know, 12 to 24 months, then hopefully it should build. I know for you, one of the things we talked about, which is fascinating to think about, is this intersection in your industry where, at most, if you're in a state that requires it, you have to have a real estate, residential real estate brokerage license, right? At the most, which your state does not, right?
Yeah.
In Ohio. And then that's at most. And then the intersection of that compared to the fact that there's really no room for mistakes in this whole lengthy transaction that you're dealing with to help someone exit, right?
I don't know if there's not room for mistakes. The big mistakes can be huge. The little mistakes are typically, you know, this was, you know, overlooked. And, you know, in a lot of the transactions that we do, there's a bank at the end of the line that will make sure those mistakes aren't made. They'll clean it up, or, you know, documents are missing. Good attorneys, good CPAs, good financial planners are there throughout the entire process. And as a good broker, you're introducing or insisting, you know, that your clients are engaging those other resources, because as a business broker, we're not attorneys, we're not accountants. Some of us are accountants, I'm not, but there are some CPAs that are now, you know, business brokers. And there are some attorneys that are business brokers, but you have to know where that chair rail is, because you don't want to be giving legal advice if you're not a lawyer to someone. So you need to hand them over to someone that can help them, for instance, write a purchase agreement if that's needed, or author up a seller carry note or a management agreement or other things like that that are necessary. But, you know, all of those things are important, but anyhow.
Yeah. And if, you know, if there's an error made, you know, it's going to come up, it's going to be caught. It's just interesting how there's not that licensing.
No, and it is strange. There are a handful of states in the U.S. that require a real estate license or a real estate brokerage license in order to sell businesses as well. And I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. I am a licensed realtor in the state of Ohio as well. And I did it for simple greedy reasons. There was no sense in not trying to sell someone's real estate with their business at the same time. And it made it easier for the client to at least have that at their disposal should they own the real estate. And I think the other thing that it does as a broker is there are ethical considerations and, you know, canons and things like that that you learn through the real estate licensing process that you automatically bring to your game as a business broker, you know. Mm-hmm. Treating your customers, for instance, with, you know, honesty, integrity, is just one of those. I mean, we usually represent the seller exclusively, but that doesn't mean we're going to walk all over the buyer, you know. And I think that the advantage of having a real estate license, in addition to that, is that you're held to a slightly higher standard.
That makes sense, and you know, it's something. It's better than nothing, at least in those states that it is required, or that people like yourself realize, like, hey, this way I can do both.
Right.
In the beginning, you were talking about when you were looking to buy, and then realized this whole industry and where the inefficiencies were, is that there were, you know, not enough brokers, and then also too many buyers, and the brokers out there were flooded with buyers.
That problem still exists today.
Yeah. So where does that challenge still hit you? And I'm guessing 7 years later, technology is used both also by the buyers at scale, which means they can do even more faster. Yeah. You know, where does that come in with you? How do you handle that?
The buyer problem hasn't gone away, and there's nothing. The reason for it is there's so many people that are pursuing good quality businesses, and they don't come up for sale very often. They certainly don't hit BizBuySell, DealStream, Axial, and publishing places like that as often as the buyers would like, because some businesses just sell word of mouth to one of their competitors, and they never see the light of day as a published listing. And they don't sell through a broker. They don't even sell. They just sell, you know, business to business.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what percentage of businesses actually do sell that way. But in the industry that we're in, Main Street to lower middle market businesses, you know, zero to $50 million business, there are probably, and this is just a guess, for every listing that I put out there that I call a good listing, when I say a good listing, it's got $300,000, $350,000 or more of cash flow per year, I will get 200 to 300 inquiries just on that one listing inside of a month or two. And then you have to sort the good quality, you know, the tire kickers, so to speak, you know, the people who are just looking at every listing out there versus the people that are genuinely interested and have financial wherewithal to buy the business. So when you pay a business broker to sell your business, that is a good portion of what you're paying for is just sorting out that many inquiries, you know, and it becomes easier with experience. You know, my first year as a business broker, I couldn't tell you a good buyer from a bad buyer. They were all great buyers as far as I was concerned. I've since learned, I kind of know, and I can intuitively, you know, just see a lead come through that somebody links to one of our landing pages for a listing that we have. And the other thing I've noticed, that the buyers that are serious, they'll pursue you. they will blow your phone up. They'll find you, and they're very tenacious. But you still have to, unfortunately, you still have to sort through and sign, you know, non-disclosure agreements for other people that are looking at your listings. And it's time consuming. So I don't think that the proportion of buyers to sellers has changed much over the last year. I do believe that technology has helped actually make listings a little more available than they used to be. So maybe we're seeing more activity, you know.
And how do you deal with that? Like, you know, if there's hundreds of inquiries coming in, how have you found to just sort through that without going crazy or spending
your whole life? Well, automation helps. You know, it used to be when I first started, you had to manually send them an NDA, you know, set it up through DocuSign, set all the fields up, have them sign. That was very time consuming. And now we automate most of that. It automatically, you know, once they hit our landing page, we get their first, last name, email address, phone number, what listing they're interested in. They automatically get sent a non-disclosure agreement, which they have to sign. And if they don't sign it, they don't see anything. But if they do sign it, I have to sign it on my end. And then they'll automatically get what we call a teaser. And it's like a SIM level one, for lack of a better term in our industry parlance. And that teaser is very confidential. It doesn't have the name or address of the business. It just gives you the high level numbers, maybe a general location like, you know, Southern Ohio or Eastern Indiana or something like that. And if they're interested beyond that, we invite them to call us. I like to have a conversation with anyone that is that interested in the business. And then we have, after that conversation, we typically will ask them for proof of funds if they're serious. And that is typically what separates the people that are really interested versus those that are not. We're not going to disclose the name of a confidential listing that we have to someone that doesn't have the financial wherewithal to buy the business. This frustrates some people. I think we do it a little differently than other brokerages do. Other brokerages might just, as soon as you sign the NDA, they'll tell you who the business is. That's nuts. Because in the example that I just used a few minutes ago, if I have 300 inquiries and all 300 of those people sign an NDA, and I tell 300 people that, you know, Acme Incorporated down the road here on Main Street is for sale, the chances are fairly high that someone's going to kiss and tell, and the word is going to get out. And then now you've severely injured that business potentially if the employees find out that they're for sale, the suppliers or vendors find out they're for sale, you know, and it's never good. So we kind of guard that really closely, and we put some additional steps in the way before we tell, you know, a potential buyer who this business is. And there's some other tactics that I use when I'm signing an NDA, for instance. I always look at the address. Where are they located? They're trying to buy a mom and pop restaurant, you know, in Southern Ohio, for instance, and they're in California. Please. I'm probably going to decline that.
Yeah.
I've heard this one before. Well, if I buy it, I'll move to Ohio. Well, move to Ohio and call me. Call me when you're here, and then I'll take the message. So this is part of that art form of knowing, you know, who to engage and who not to engage.
Yeah. And I really like that, because I remember when we spoke initially, I was thinking about that, and I don't know any specific brokers that do it the other way that you said, which is, you know, NDAs for everyone, everyone signs, and then here's all the info. Like, I don't talk to any of those brokers. I think I end up observational biased. I talk to a different level of brokers just in general, people like yourself. But it's interesting to think about that, like being selective, and then even the NDA, and then here's this essentially still it's a redacted level of information. And then if you have the proof of funds, then we can really, like, then we can talk serious stuff.
Yeah. And I think you owe that to your client, you know, that level of confidentiality and care, because let's face it, you know, if you inadvertently let someone, the wrong person, know that this business is for sale, it could be a competitor. Now they go down the road and start poaching their employees and whispering in their ear saying, hey, Kevin is selling his business or whatever. Mm-hmm. You've done some serious harm.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not good. And so it is interesting to think of that at scale, where the balance, I think, is always important with the technology, the automation, everyone gets an NDA, and then the manual part, which isn't just like full automation, like everyone can just walk themselves through the whole process. I think that's important. How do you see buyers dealing with that? Like you said, sometimes they get frustrated. They don't want to have to do the proof of funds.
Yeah.
I know that
you
don't care. That's not who your responsibility is, but like, are you seeing buyers changing and getting more?
Oh, they're getting more attuned to it. And when I, you know, even compared to 6 years ago, I had people 6 years ago when I first started literally yelling and screaming at me on the phone and saying, why would I show you my financials if I can't see theirs? it's my rules. I make the rules. You want to see it. You know, I see your proof of funds. Otherwise, we're not talking anymore. Now, when I push back and ask for proof of funds, it's a little more automatic. It's almost like the buyer pool out there is getting trained and getting attuned to this, which is good, because then it saves those additional conversations, which can eat up a lot of your time.
Yeah.
The one group that's still stubborn, and there's a little bit of a gap here, is private equity groups, independent sponsors, firms that act like private equity or family equity groups. Most of these groups will tell you they don't have proof of funds. Oh, we got all of our capitals locked up over here in this fund, or we can raise the capital per deal, et cetera, et cetera. And when I push for proof of funds from them, I always get a lot of pushback. Let's just put it that way. I don't care. I can start a website tomorrow and just say I'm a private equity group and without any proof. And I direct you to my website and you're supposed to believe me.
Yeah,
I'm not that guy. I'm not going to be an easy pushover. You know, you're going to have to show me that you have the financial wherewithal before I disclose to you that a very large business in, you know, the Toledo area is for sale or something like that. You know,
in your evolution, 6 years in, starting 7 years with trying to buy one and then seeing what that whole process was like, how do you feel, or what do you do, and what's the mindset around industry specialization? Do you have like a business size kind of focus? Where is that? Because I know some brokers are like, I only sell these kind of industry, this kind of industry. Others are like, anything in this size. Mm-hmm. Is it the region for you? Like, what have you found over the years?
We're industry agnostic, just as a firm, and always have been. there are certain businesses I simply won't, I won't muck with. And it's just because the juice isn't worth the squeeze, and I've got better things to spend my time on. And I don't care to list those businesses now, because I don't want to prejudice anyone else. But because of my background, I tend to gravitate toward what I call the hardware side of Sears. I love manufacturing, you know, distribution, supply chain, HVAC, electrical, only because I spent 25 years in operations management and manufacturing. Now, having said that, I have sold, I don't know how many restaurants and how many decades, and I've never sold a salon. I don't want to sell a salon. I don't have any business selling a salon. But I've sold things that were well outside of my wheelhouse. And I have actually inadvertently become semi-expert at daycares.
Interesting.
I don't know how, but you sell enough of them, you kind of know where the bodies are buried. You know which questions to ask, and you know how to prep your seller or your client and the buyer for a successful closing, only because you know what the important metrics are in that business. And it's easier to also evaluate them. Once you've done one, you've done another, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I, as it relates to specialization, I think it's fair to say, and if you're coming into this industry and you've got a great list of contacts, let's just say you work for a big CPA firm and you want to sell CPA firms, you're probably going to do okay, right? Because you've got a fairly good pool of potential sellers to draw from, and buyers for that matter. But the specializations tend to find you rather than you finding them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the truest statement out there. There are some people that get it, that sold one or two vets, you know, veterinary practices, and that's all they do. And they make a killing at it. And there's nothing wrong with specializing that. But I think the specializations kind of find you by accident. So for instance, your clientele sees you on social media. You've sold two or three daycares this past year. A daycare owner sees that, they call you. Guess what? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Same thing. Same thing with restaurants. If you're, you know, selling a lot of restaurants, they're going to continue to find you. So I think it's more the specialization is not something you seek. It seeks you out after a while.
Which is interesting, because the brokers that I know that specialize, that's what happened to them. Is years into their career, or something happened where maybe a string, maybe a couple, maybe one big one, and was like, wait a second, this is amazing. And let me see if I can just keep going. Or like Claudia Vilas was on the podcast. He focuses on roofing. Broker for years, had a big listing that sold for roofing that he came, that, you know, he was involved with. And then that referred into another one that then I think closed in like 3 months after that. So basically two in a 3 to 6 month window. He's like, wait a second, like, this is the thing. And then my question for you, Brandon, is how long until you become the daycare broker and everyone online knows you as the daycare broker? You have a daycare broker podcast. When is that happening?
Lord, you know, what's sad is I've never worked in a daycare. I've paid a lot of daycares. I have two kids. I've never worked in a daycare. And I usually, when I was picking up my children when I was younger, I'd go in there, get my kid. I couldn't wait to get out.
Yeah.
It reminded me too much of elementary school. And you know, but in the state of Ohio, daycares are still fairly lucrative, because Ohio is they have a progressive attitude toward daycares, and they do a lot of grants. And they work with daycares quite well. So Ohio is a kind of a rich market for daycare. So if you list one, you'll get a lot of attention, as long as the numbers are okay.
Yeah.
Not all are created equal, but there's still such a high demand for them. And the number of people that are trying to add their third or fourth daycare to their portfolio is just increasing year after year after year. And a lot of your buyers are repeat buyers. You know, you sold one to them, that was the third. Now they're going for number four. They see that you just listed one, and that's usually the first phone call you get.
Yeah.
But as far as me being the daycare guy, I'm not saying no. I just don't know. I just don't see that ever happening. We'll see.
All right. Well, we'll mark this, and then we'll see in the future if it does ever happen.
Check back with me in 2 years and we'll see what happens, right?
We can reference this part of the conversation and be like, you weren't making it happen, but like you said, specializations find you. So you never know. It is fascinating how that works and like where people go and what they end up specializing in, especially if it's not their background. Right. Again, like you haven't run a daycare and you said, hey, I'm going to be a broker that sells daycares or, you know, Claudio wasn't, hey, I ran a roofing company, so let me sell roofing companies. Like that was nowhere in his kind of trajectory. So
something that is unique about this business. If you like to learn a lot of different things about different businesses, you'll get a quick education. And once you dig into someone's financials and you help them figure out what their business, their fair market value of the business is, and you've seen those, and then you see others and others and others, you quickly become fairly tuned into that industry because you're going to do some research when you go to list a business like that.
Yeah.
You're going to do some outreach. You have got to figure out what the right questions are to ask and what the, where the bodies are buried, you know, where's the soft underbelly. Like for instance, in the state of Ohio, your SUTQ rating from state of Ohio matters. It's, I believe it's bronze, silver, and gold. And the higher you are on that standing, the more you get from the state of Ohio when you get onto some of these entitlement programs like Title 12 and a few others, you get more money back. So those are questions that if you don't know what you're doing, you won't ask and you won't bang on that drum when you go to list that business and say, hey, this has an SUTQ rating of gold. Well, heck, most of the work is done. If you buy it, you don't have to, all you have to do is not lose that rating. Which, you know, if you're an accomplished operator, you know what you're doing and you won't.
Sure seems, Brandon. I don't know. I'm just saying. I don't know. We might not have to wait 2 years to check back in with you and see if you end up with a... all right. So I know one of the things when we spoke in the past is like all of this leading up in the transactions. Then you got the transactional cadence. You told me something that you do that's unique and special that you feel really helps the transaction. Once the buyer and the seller have lined up, like you've got the agreement and you're now in like the rest of the phases, that you do some weekly meetings, no matter what, just for everybody. Like share that because I think it's, you know, it's there's no real secret sauce, but I think it's one of those things where it's like, I think it's so valuable and it seems common sense, but I don't think a lot of brokers are doing it.
I don't know if they are or not. I've just found out what works for us in this office. And that is once you have a signed agreement and you're in, let's just call it due diligence, right? Where information is needed back and forth. And it's important that you're timely, that it, you know, you're responsive, et cetera, et cetera. It can be a very frustrating journey for the seller who provided all that information to upfront, but then then a bank gets involved. They're talking to the buyer, telling the buyer, hey, we need, I'll give you an example. We need the financials for the last 2 years on their profit and loss statements by month. And there's a reason that they want it. I know why they want it by month, because they're going to try and look for seasonality. They're going to try and do a trailing 12 month analysis, whatever. But the buyer then comes to me and says, hey, I need these financials by month from Mr. Seller. If I go to Mr. Seller and say, hey, the buyer needs this, seller gets upset and thinks, well, the buyer's just jacking me around. If I get them on the phone once a week, once every 2 weeks, I don't care. It can be 5, 10, 15 minutes. What my client, the seller, finally discovers is it's not the buyer who's yanking his chain. It's the bank. And the banks are banks. I mean, they're the ones underwriting this deal, and they underwrite the majority of deals, you know, in the United States every year. So then we don't vilify, my client doesn't vilify the buyer and start to get a bad rapport with them before they even close. Because what's really important after you close is the buyer and the seller have to cohabitate and they have to cooperate for 30, 60, 190, 180 days, whatever that period is. And it's important that they establish a good working relationship. And the best way in the world to make sure that neither party vilifies the other is just to get them on the phone and have them talk and say, hey, this is what I need. And it sometimes the meeting doesn't happen because there's nothing new to report. Sometimes as you get closer to closing, the meetings become 30 minutes, 35, 45 minutes, because now we're starting transition talk. Okay, well, you know, I'm gonna apply for the cable and internet and, you know, here's what we're going to do with the employees and how many do you have and, you know, et cetera. It's all of those things start to get worked out. And it's better to keep them talking than not. I've just learned that the moment they stop talking, that's when deals fall apart.
Yeah, it's interesting too. And if we think about it from a psychological standpoint, which is what I've always done in the past from a sales perspective, is that if not careful, the messenger will be making the other person the bad guy, right? You have to call it the higher authority close. It's like you want to be the bad guy. It's always me and you versus the problem. Now, the challenge is, and the classic dynamic is that if you, broker, are dealing with the seller and acting as the intermediary and mediator and messenger, then by default, the dynamic becomes the buyer is then the bad guy, right? Now it's you and your client versus the bad guy, which is in this case, the buyer. When you have your meetings like you do, now you're not part of the message. It is now the seller and the buyer versus whoever's getting in the way, which is the bank or a CPA or whatever. And now they're working together against the enemy to try to accomplish the common goal, where normally it would be you and the seller working together against all outside forces, which is not good for that dynamic. Well, so I love how, like, with deep psychological level, like how valuable that is, you know, where most people don't realize it, because you need to make sure that the two of them are together until the deal closes. And then, like you said, afterwards, they're probably not just walking away from each other.
Right. Their relationship with me matters a lot less after the close. Not saying that we don't stay in touch, because I call buyers and sellers all the time after closing just to make sure there wasn't anything, you know, they needed, something missed, whatever, you name it. But you take this us versus them approach and give that to the buyer and the seller. It's them versus the bank, and they're just trying to get all this stuff across the finish line. We just closed one the other day, and it was a plumbing company being bought by an HVAC company because they're trying to add that service. And it was a beautiful closing because we just kept the guys talking, you know, and they would meet even a few times, you know, after hours, just to kind of go over some inventory concerns and, okay, what are we going to do? How should we integrate this, et cetera. And I'm not saying that I'm on every one of those calls. I try to be. There are limits to everyone's schedule, but initially, I am definitely on those first several calls, just trying to set up the cadence. And but if you can get them talking and I'm not doing the talking, you know, hey, 90% of the problem solved.
You know, from everything I've learned about this process, this industry, you know, the dynamics that you're dealing with, is the sellers are generally picking a buyer that they like, somebody they trust, somebody they feel is going to continue the business for their employees, their legacy, their whatever, all that they created. And so there is no good reason to keep them apart. This isn't a lawsuit where attorneys have to keep everyone from talking to each other because of those reasons, right? Like, lawyers want to get paid, and then they want to make sure there's adversarial stuff and no one, you know, undoes whatever they're trying to fight for. And it's like, but this is different. This isn't an us versus them.
You know, there's 101 different reasons to do it. There's probably some business brokers and professionals out there that would say I'm nuts.
Yeah.
But I can tell you what worked for me and what has worked for this office is just making sure that dialogue stays intact, because 2 weeks of silence can kill a deal.
Yeah.
You can get a call from your client, the seller, and say, hey, I haven't heard a darn thing from this guy. Can you find me another buyer? Well, wait a minute. Why are we putting horns on this poor buyer? He's waiting on information from his bank. Or he's waiting on clearance from this. Well, if you keep them talking, then the other one knows what the other one's up against. And, you know, there's, again, no vilification of either party by the other party. And that's important. That's really important. If anyone needs to be a heavy, it needs to be me. If anybody wants to get mad at me, but not each other.
Right. It's always okay for you to be the bad cop, or the bad guy, but not the other party, right? Like, that's totally okay.
Right.
And it's interesting because, you know, a common phrase, especially in sales, is that time kills all deals. And I think it's true, but I think the underlying part of that is that time kills all deals if there's silence, and silence kills all deals.
That was the point I was getting ready to make. It's not the time. It's the time. Yes, time is one component, but if there's too much silence in that time, people lose faith in the other party, et cetera, et cetera. Or someone changes their mind. Buyer changes his mind, or the seller says, you know what? We had a great year this year. I'm not selling. Seen that happen, you know? Yeah. So
Yeah. And where, you know, obviously time kills all deals, like enough things could go sideways that aren't recoverable. But having been involved with some transactions in the past, like real estate type things that were really long because one problem after another kept popping up, given enough time, you could solve all of those problems as long as everyone is still on board with the process. You'll always figure it out. And so it's an interesting balance between time and silence and, you know, the like, we got to do this quick. It's like, yeah, but if everyone's just engaged, it will just happen like on the flow of a normal transaction.
Yeah. If you pair your client, the seller, right buyer, and they truly are the right buyer, you're not pushing on a string. You're actually trying to catch up to them sometimes, you know, like, holy cow. Okay. Yeah. We're that far along. And you're trying your best as a business broker to grease the skids, to get the resources that they need, the processes, the paperwork, whoever the touch points are, you know, in their hands, but you're filling in the gaps where there is that silence. You know, you're getting on the phone and saying, hey, Mr. Buyer, I haven't heard anything from you in a while. Is everything okay? What can I do to help? Mm-hmm. Likewise, you know, you're calling your client saying, hey, buyers in due diligence, they requested whatever document and I haven't heard a peep. Did you send that to them without me knowing about it? And I need to know that those things are sent. And you're doing your job, you know, and sometimes it's easy to forget to do those things, but you have to have a process where you're doing it. You know, you're checking these boxes as a broker to make sure these deliverables are met, because that silence and that time are your enemy. They really are. And you made a really good point there.
For sure. I think that's fascinating to just think about. All right. So let's get to the next segment, because this is another thing that I wouldn't say kills all deals. Sometimes it doesn't make deals happen, which is the marketing side. And so this is the part where we talk about marketing tips. Obviously, you have to have that full funnel pipeline. You know, it helps when you go into maybe a franchise or a group and there's some leads for you to work on. But like you said in the beginning, you know, and constantly, especially because I know the dynamic is once you get busy on some transactions, you're dealing with hundreds of buyers, like, you know, things start to slip on the marketing side and it's tough to do all of it. So when you think of marketing tips, if you were to think of stuff that, you know, would help brokers or that you found has helped you keep the pipeline going, keep it full, you know, at any time, what do you have? What comes to mind?
God, there's so many. There's so many facets to marketing yourself in this business. And let's face it, brands are brands. There's, you know, I don't know how many different business brokerages out there, and most people can't even recite their names, but they'll never forget your face, your name, and, you know, your performance. I'll just give you a few anecdotal stories. Like, you know, beginning of last year, things had slowed down. It seemed like the pipeline was starting to dry up, you know, so get a little worried. And I'd forgotten something an old business broker told me, that, you know, when times like that hit, the people that you talked to 2 and 3 and 4 years ago, why not pick up the phone and call them? So I actually did that. I was going through some old emails and some old files, and I thought, well, these are ones that never listed. Let's just call them. I called them, and I think I spent, and this is probably no exaggeration, 4 hours one afternoon. I just picked up my cell phone and started pacing around the office, which I love to do when I'm talking. Yeah. And I called, I don't know how many, but I got 4 listings inside of those 4 hours, just from calling some old cold leads, as we call them, right? Don't forget, you know, the ones that you left behind, because sometimes, you know, if you have a good CRM and you're making good notes in there, you're saying you call this person in 6 months, 12 months, et cetera. We all get busy. And sometimes, you know, you're not at your computer. It's not easy to make those notes in your CRM, and that stuff goes by the wayside. That's just one little nugget. The other one is, you can't afford to sit in an office and run a virtual office and not get out and meet people that are in the business community that you're in, CPAs, lawyers, financial planners, other business owners. Join a networking group. I don't care if it's a 3-letter acronym or a 5-letter acronym. Join some local chambers of commerce and some networking, something that you're comfortable in that has a good mix of people that are what we call centers of influence, right? So for business brokers, CPAs usually are a great center of influence for us. They're a great resource because they typically know before anyone else that someone's going to sell their business. Lawyers are probably second, financial planners a second or third. But then just getting your name out there in a networking group I can't say how important that is. And it's also good just to get you out of the office every once in a while. Right?
Yeah.
Gives you a chance to get out of your sweatpants, you know, and actually, you know, storm the weather and go out and meet the people that matter. That's another one. And then, you know, don't be shy about LinkedIn, Facebook. Those things actually they do produce leads, you know. You have to have a presence out there and you have to keep at it. The other one is when you close a business, make sure you ask for a Google review from the buyer and the seller. I know it sounds crazy, but this business is people look you up. Yep. And if you have 7 reviews and 2 of those are not favorable, but you've closed 100 businesses, how many review opportunities did you miss? Yeah. So be unapologetic about it and just tell your clients and both buyer and the seller, hey, you know, what drives our business is word of mouth, and Google review is definitely one of those words of mouth. And I just closed one earlier this week and got 2 Google reviews out of it. Buyer and seller were happy, you know, I'll take it. So don't be bashful about that because that stuff matters.
I think it's true. I heard a quote recently and it was, which I'm going to start using, and it's super important because it's fundamental to the kind of stuff that we do, is that you are who Google says you are, right? which is a more succinct way than what I've always said is, you know, it's at some point, somebody's going to research you either after they talked to you the first time or they're referred to you or they found something that led to you and then they want to Google and just find out, can they trust you? Right. And you are who Google says you are anymore. And it's tough for some people because they don't realize how powerful that is. And I always joke with people, it's like, well, Google your name. Like how where do you rank, you know, as yourself and what will people find?
Yeah. And I started off in this industry coming from an industry where you didn't really toot your own horn. Your work kind of spoke for itself. And it took me a while to realize this. So I'll add one to your saying, is that if you're not willing to toot your own horn, trust me, not everybody else will. So if you can get someone else to toot your own horn on Google, great, but you also have to toot your own horn too. So you have to get on Facebook, you have to get on LinkedIn, you have to be on Instagram, and you have to toot your own horn and say, hey, this is what we do and this is why we're good.
Yeah, I think that's important. It's there's always a good balance with the self-promotion where, you know, the content, the education, and coming from that aspect of sharing and want to help people, not just the look at me, I'm amazing, I won these awards, and definitely not the, hey, here's my listing, here's my closing, and that's all your posts are, is, you know, about the highlights, right? Like it's got to be more than that.
Without a doubt. And hey, I'm not trying to castigate anyone else for not doing it. It's tough. It's hard. And it's, you know, you only have so many hours in a day and marketing is usually the last thing on your mind. You're too busy answering the phone if you're doing your job well.
Yeah.
And getting back with clients, getting back with lenders and trying to get the next deal across the finish line or the next listing up, you know, and out there. But you have to take a couple hours a week and sharpen the axe. You just have to. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in some sales arenas that I have worked in and consulted in, you know, the premise is that what you have today is a result of what you did 90 days ago.
Right? I couldn't agree with that more.
In your world, I think that could be three months to 3 years.
Oh,
easily. Whole span. Like, this is you're not planting a seed that turns into an apple tree tomorrow, right?
No. And business brokerage is not a get rich overnight scheme. It never has been. I'm not saying that there hasn't been some people out there that have probably done it, but you have to lay the seeds, you know, you have to lay the foundation, and it's not laid in one day. It's in months and years.
All right. Now I know, because we spoke about this, there's one that was also on your list of marketing tips. It's not really a marketing tip. It's a growth tip, but it's not a marketing tip per se, but it's that it's okay to say no sometimes. I think that one's really important because sometimes salespeople get in the mode, they say yes to everything, they want everything, they move everything forward. If you've done it long enough, you realize how terrible that is.
Yeah, and most business brokers, when they start up, will be encouraged to take every listing that they can, because that's how you cut your teeth and that's how you learn. And you want to, if you're going to fumble a football, you don't want to fumble it on a $20 million deal. I'm here to tell you, you don't want to fumble a football at all on any deal of any size. So there are just some clients. There are even some, you know, clients that are sellers and clients that are buyers that are just, they're not the right mix. They're not the right buyer for this person's business. And I have just matured to that point now where I have told clients, this is not a listing I'm willing to take. There's just not a good chemistry. You know, things get off on the wrong foot, and or you see the red flags that you learn to recognize that this is probably not somebody that really is serious about getting to closing. Save yourself the time and cut that darn cord now.
Yeah.
It's when you're new, it's not easy to figure that out, but there's always that little devil on your shoulder. I don't care what age and what experience level you are, that there's a problem. That's probably screaming at you for a reason. Sometimes it's worth taking a chance. And if you're new to this, you're probably more likely to do that. But yeah, no to somebody is probably the right answer. Turn them over to another business broker or let them go find someone else that they can work with. Do yourself that favor, do them that favor.
Yeah, I think that's the mark of a professional and someone in a profession is knowing who you can help and who you can't, who you want to help, who you don't want to work with. It's a theme that comes up a lot on the podcast with the guests, you know, the
brokers
and lenders of like, you know, just don't work with people who are lying or shady or, you know, not very nice people.
Even lenders aren't all created equal. I mean, even within the same branch, it's at some bank, there's, you know, one loan officer that's better than the other. Within the community that we work with, in, you know, business owners, you know, the red flags are typically there at the beginning, and you will ignore them if you're desperate. But as you get less desperate, you mature and you go, okay, I can't see this guy ever or this gal ever going to closing. And the business that we're in, we don't get paid until it closes. So you can put a lot of effort into something that never goes anywhere, and you've lost, you know, you could lose, you know, 100 to 200 hours in a year on one engagement, just going down a rabbit hole that never was going anywhere. So
I think that's great. And I think that's a really good list. For anyone listening to this, a business broker, go back through the list that Brandon was saying and kind of flew through. There's a lot of good tips in there. So let's go to the last segment. This is always interesting because it's such a wide range of responses. This is the deal that got away. This is the lessons of the lost deal. You know, what kind of experience happened and then what kind of lessons from it, maybe a cautionary tale for brokers, cautionary tale for business owners selling or buyers or whoever, you know, it might be. What comes to mind, which it's always interesting too, because sometimes like they just kind of stack up and here's like, I don't even know how to pick one. If you have one, that's kind of a good example. What do you got?
I have one and I've had two just like this, where if you don't read the tea leaves, through the engagement, you're missing something important. So it was a very lucrative listing, very sellable numbers in an industry that was very popular and got a lot of attention. When I say a lot of attention, at one point I remember at the end, there were 350 total inquiries and something like 100 to 200 NDAs signed. And wow. I had introduced this seller, I think it was eight or so potential suitors, and there were 6 to 7 LOIs offered.
Wow.
Now, not all at once. Now, one would be coming in, and then the seller just kept finding a way to shoot this one down. We would go back and negotiate and get it just the right way. And then at the 11th hour, my client, the seller, would say, you know, I'm making so much money here. I don't even know why I would sell this. Why would I sell this for that amount of money? I'm like, because that's the price we put out there, guy. You want me to put it out there for more? And this kept going on and on and on. And at that particular, I remember that year very well. A few other deals had fallen through, listings didn't happen. And this became a fairly decent sized listing. And I got emotionally attached to it. I'm like, this one we got to sell. You know, this one's going to be a decent payday. I've already put a lot of work into it. And I just kept pushing on this string. And then finally, at the very, very end, it just became evident to me after he turned down the 7th offer, this gentleman has zero intention of selling whatsoever. And I have been taken for a ride. And I'll bet, and this is probably a fair guesstimate, 300 hours, 400 hours that year, just working on that one with all the trips we took to the person's facility, meeting buyers coming in from out of town, you know, at various restaurants or wherever. And you can put a lot of time and effort into something like that. And this kind of goes back to the saying no thing. At some point during the middle of this, you know, after he turned down the third or fourth offer, I should have just surrendered the engagement back to the guy and just said, look, you know, it's obvious you have no intention of selling. And I could tell that he was just trying to wait me out.
Yeah.
They're just overtures, you know, just little things that he would say during the selling process. And it didn't matter what I brought to this guy, he would find a way to get out of it. And he was just one of those reluctant sellers, you know, he had seller's remorse. He realized what he was getting ready to do and changed his mind. And what he didn't have the heart to say to his broker was, you know, Brandon, I've changed my mind and I'm just not going to pursue this anymore. And it could have saved us both the time and effort. So recognize. You know, recognize what a ready, willing, and able seller looks like as much as a ready, willing, and able buyer looks like. And that's not always easy to do.
No. And I think if you've gone through scenarios like that, whether broker or just in life in general, then you start to realize in retrospect the red flags that were there that you ignored. And then you realize like, okay, so if that happens again, there is a pattern and maybe stop it and have an honest conversation. You don't have to like abandon completely in that moment after the second buyer is rejected, but like realize like, okay, when we've put up or shut up moment, like, are we going to do this or not?
Yeah.
And it is fascinating. It is wild to think of that in retrospect to how many hours was invested in that.
Well, I mean, your time is money. Everyone's time is money, but in this particular industry, your time is worth a lot of money. And the opportunity cost of sticking with a dead listing that's going nowhere like that meant that there was probably other things that I was missing on this side, you know, that I should have been pursuing post haste and, you know, shoring up the business that way. But, you know, I learned my lesson and I'm not saying it won't happen again, but it won't happen like that. That's for darn sure.
It definitely won't happen again, especially when you become the daycare broker to the star. You're definitely not going to let that happen again. I didn't throw that in there yet.
I appreciate it.
So Brandon, I appreciate you being here. You're going to stick around. We're going to do the after show like always. But for anyone who's tuning in, they want to get in touch with you. They want to find out more about what you're doing. The website for your group is businessforsaleohio.com. They can find you on LinkedIn, Brandon Owens. Your email will be in the show notes as well. If anyone wants to reach out to you, maybe you have some questions about, you know, being a broker, maybe you're a business owner and you want to sell, reach out to Brandon. You obviously got to know him pretty well in the last, 45, 50 minutes. If you're hundreds and hundreds of buyers, you know, please feel free to email him. Just kidding. Don't. But Brandon, I appreciate you being on here and sharing. And I love the story and how open you were about the journey and the, you know, especially the challenge at the beginning, but also, you know, what you've done and how you operate. So thank you for sharing all that.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
All right. And for everyone else, thank you for being here. Hopefully you got some value from this, no matter where you are, whatever side of the transaction you're on, you know, a lot of interesting things, both about the marketing side, but also the transactions and, you know, making sure that everyone's working together and not against each other, which is how like sales usually will pit people against each other, which I love about what Brandon was saying. And then, you know, just about having systems and process. I think all that's great. So hopefully you got some value, some notes from this. Make sure to like and subscribe and follow and or share. You know, one of the things, if you've heard me on this podcast and other shows that I've done in the past, like one of the biggest things I want to do is amplify things like this, messages like this, professionals like Brandon, so we can get more of this out there to hopefully fill this industry with more professionals, kind of leading to what Brandon said in the beginning, where it was hard to find a broker and then it was just a mess. And that's what kind of triggered him. So please share this, get this out there. That's why we do the show. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.